We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 136.
On today's show, we take a look at what was happening in other parts of the world when the future United States was signing the Declaration of Independence.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to The Archaeology Show. How's it going?
Pretty good. Excited for today's episode.
Yeah. So we're still in an RV park.
Yep.
A little life update for us, because we're always in an RV park. Well, not always.
Well, not always. We do some boondocking and stay at random places, but we're in a park this time.
Yeah.
And it's right on the Puget Sound. It's really pretty, and it's a great area. We're enjoying it.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of cold here. Like, we had the fireplace on this morning.
Yeah. Like, there's no smoke, and it's not hot. So, like, I really couldn't ask for anything more than that. So sorry for anybody who is in or around the fires in Northern California right now. I know they are raging like crazy, and it's just not a great time.
And for context, if you're listening to this 3 years from now,
yes,
it is late August 2021.
Yeah.
That's when we're recording this.
Bad fire season.
We're in Northwestern Washington State.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, well, we are doing another Timelines episode, and this time around, the anchor event is the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
And when did that happen?
1776.
What?
I know. Right on the 4th of July. They're like, you know what? We're going to have fireworks tonight. We may as well sign this today.
Guys, the 4th is coming soon. We need to sign this thing today.
That's right. So, no. Anyway, that's the event. And one of the reasons we came up with this as the event is because we actually visited, for the first time for both of us, Philadelphia a couple months ago when we were back there staying in Pennsylvania for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So we got to see Independence Hall. We got to see all the, you know, major sites over there for early America, because Philadelphia was an early capital of the United States.
It was the capital before Washington, D.C. So there's a lot of the buildings in the I think it's either Old Town or Old City is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
That area, it's full of these old buildings that were really significant to the development of the United States as a country. So a lot of really important things happened there. And we saw an Independence Hall, and we saw the Liberty Bell from outside, because we had already waited in line for Independence Hall. We just didn't have time to wait in another 2-hour line to get in there too. So, but at least you can see it from outside.
Yeah. So we didn't do any research for this. It's all based on us visiting there. And of course the movie National Treasure.
Your favorite movie.
Yeah. No, actually, I was actually watching bits of the movie from YouTube, because we were standing behind Independence Hall.
Yeah.
Well, behind is subjective depending on your perspective, but we were standing back where they have the line, and they had people spaced out, and they were being real good about, you know, COVID and all that, and small numbers on the inside. But I was like, oh, you know, I remember this part of the movie, and, you know, it's everything's a scam in Hollywood. It's it turns out that the model of Independence Hall that they use is actually at Knott's Berry Farm in California.
I know, which is so crazy, because like, when you watch the movie, because we went and watched the movie not too long after that, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you were watching it while we were waiting in line, but then we watched the actual movie, and like, it looks like you're actually at Independence Hall, or they were actually at Independence Hall. So
I don't know why there's a model of Independence Hall, and what other like early colonial things are there at Knott's Berry Farm?
I don't know. I've never been there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Is it the National Treasure Ride?
Like, oh,
can you actually run across the roof? I don't know.
No idea.
Anyway, let's get to the show.
Yeah.
So
enough National Treasure talk.
So yeah, we're gonna talk about a couple other things later on in the show, segments 2 and 3 that took place at the same time, roughly.
Right.
So right now, let's do a brief history, according to Chris and Rachel, of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So, as everybody knows, as if you've looked at our flag ever, there were 13 original colonies. That's what the red and white stripes stand for, that were eventually ruled by Britain. I say eventually because parts of this, what became this country, were actually discovered, pretend Native Americans never saw it.
Right.
Yeah. No, settled. Yeah.
They were settled by people from different countries and different places in Europe. So
notably France and Spain.
Yeah.
But also Denmark and not Denmark, like the Netherlands.
Yeah. I think all of them had small colonies around here and there. I mean, Florida was huge with Spanish, obviously, and Scottish people in North Carolina because, you know, the Highland Games are still held there every year. Like there's a large Scottish ancestry population, which I guess is technically still part of the UK, but still.
Yeah. And there's the Outlander reference for today. So take a drink of bourbon or scotch.
Yeah, obviously scotch. It's
obviously scotch.
I mean, it wouldn't be an episode if I didn't talk about Outlander. That's my national treasure.
That's right. No, it's Scotland's national treasure.
Oh,
okay. So, yeah. Hashtag Jamie.
Wow. Okay. So, okay. That was news to me, sir.
Hey, when we visited Scotland, I had to go on the Outlander tour alongside the Monty Python tour.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so yes, 13 colonies eventually ruled by Britain. This is, again, there's a lot of events that led to the need to declare independence from Britain, right?
Right.
Not just the signing of the declaration, but the actual need to declare. So there's tons of things, but this is a really quick overview history. So there was the French and Indian War, which ended in 1763, which at the end of that war, it basically solidified Britain's hold on the colonies.
Right.
You know, they were tenuous at best, but then everybody's like, okay, yeah, fine, you guys can have them. So after that, in order to help pay for that war, the British began taxing the colonies more heavily, much more heavily, which led to a number of things, which we're going to talk about next. These are all acts. The British loved laws, and most of those laws had to do with taxes. Probably taxes or beheading. So, you know.
So basically the British monarch, George, one of the Georges, I assume, right? He was kind of treating the colonies as like a cash cow, sort of. Because there's a lot of money coming out of the colonies at that point. So it was, sounds like it was basically like a money grab by the king.
Could have been, yeah. So the Sugar Act of 1764 imposed taxes on all imported refined sugar and molasses from non-British Caribbean sources.
Ah, I guess keeping it in the family.
I know, right? Mm-hmm. It says Caribbean sources. I'm like, is that the only place we found sugar? Like, where did you get sugar before you discovered, you know, America? Like, a couple hundred years before that, where'd sugar come from?
Oh, I don't know. Probably, you know,
sweetener. Or did they even have a sweetener?
They did. There's honey and stuff, too, you know. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure where sugar.
Like refined sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I don't know the history of sugar, but
it's possible there was no refined sugar prior to discovering
maybe
these types of sources.
Yeah, but I do know that the Caribbean islands were owned by lots of different countries, so they were probably all making their own version of refined sugar, and so what the king was trying to do here was keep the money flowing to the British sources and not the other country sources.
Yeah, the next one I feel like we're still suffering from today. The Stamp Act of 1765 required that all documents and printed materials have a stamp that you could only get by paying a tax, which is essentially the way we do it now.
Yeah.
The post office is a pseudo government entity.
Yeah.
And you have to buy stamps. That's a tax.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
that's true. Yeah, I suspect that these are a little bit more of the like ink pad, although I don't think they used ink pads the way we do, but like ink pad stamp onto a piece of paper kind of a situation, because I doubt they were printing like actual stamps. But
some of them were, because the colonists didn't like it and refused to use the stamps and actually burned them.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
So either they burned paper versions of stamps, or they burned the
actual stamps.
The actual stamps.
Yeah.
Either way, they were burning shit.
Yeah, they didn't like it. They burned them.
Yeah.
So 1767, keep in mind, there's 2 years from the last thing that we mentioned. I imagine a lot more happened since then.
Yeah.
But 1767, the Townshend Acts, was an attempt to exert authority over colonists by suspending assemblies of colonials who didn't cooperate and enforce the collection of revenue duties. So anytime you made money, you got taxed on it.
Right.
And you did not have the right to assemble anymore, basically.
So you couldn't get together and talk about how you didn't want to pay said taxes anymore, basically, is what they're trying to do with that.
Yeah, they're just putting a stop to that.
Yeah, just like exerting more control that they didn't want.
Yeah. So A few years later, 1770, British soldiers were threatened and taunted by a mob of colonials in Boston, and the British soldiers opened fire and killed five people. And this is known as the Boston Massacre.
Indeed.
So I've heard of the Boston Massacre just in name, but I didn't really know what it was. The soldiers, interestingly enough, were defended by future President John Adams, resulting in acquittals and reduced sentences.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was wide knowledge when he was running for president. I'm sure he squashed that one so people didn't really know about it.
Well, this, I don't know if justice was swifter back then, probably not in the British regime, but this was 1770 or 1771 that probably would have happened. But John Adams wouldn't become president for, God, at least another 20 years.
Like 20 years,
True. Anyway, 1773, the Tea Act. And this is getting to some things you guys may know about here shortly. 1773, the Tea Act. This was partly to help the struggling British East India Tea Company. But basically, they imposed the what they called the Townsend Tax. And British tea was typically cheaper back then. And the Townsend Tax was put on things that weren't British tea, basically. And since the colonials, in essence, purchased the cheaper tea from the British East India Tea Company, this helped legitimize the taxation of the colonies through the Townsend Act. Hmm. So essentially, people still had to drink their tea, and they were getting it here because it was cheaper, and it was everything else was more heavily taxed.
Yeah, so like they were buying the tea because it was cheaper, but because they were buying that tea, it was reinforcing the greater control that the Townsend Act was exerting onto colonists.
Sounds like it,
kind of how I understand that.
Yeah, it's all very complex.
Yes.
Later on in 1773, at the end of the year in December, colonists in Boston, again Boston, they just weren't happy with what was going on.
There's a lot of people there at that time, and the rebellions all clearly stemmed from there.
Indeed. But they had a protest against taxation without representation, which you probably heard of. And a few colonists disguised themselves as Mohawk Indians, boarded ships, and dumped all the tea from the British East India Company into the Boston Harbor. So there's your Boston Tea Party. And in 1774, the Continental Congress was established. This was the colonials' first attempt to basically start to self-govern. Aside from, you know, there were people elected to government there to run the, you know, to run counties and towns and as mayors and things like that. But it was all basically, you know, puppets of the British government. The Continental Congress was an attempt to, self-govern and bring everybody together.
And they're probably facing repercussions for the, the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party. So they probably did this as a way to like help organize with the repercussions that they knew were coming. So
speaking of, the next set of acts, and there's quite a few of them, were formed to basically punish Massachusetts and dissuade other colonies from rebelling, like Massachusetts did. So they did a lot of things. These are called the Intolerable or Coercive Acts, the Intolerable Acts.
Oh, you mean the Unforgivable Curses?
The Unforgivable Acts, yes.
Sorry, I had to get my little Harry Potter reference
there
in there.
So the we'll just mention a few of them. The Boston Port Act, which closed the port of Boston until colonists paid for all the destroyed tea. That's got to be quite the hit.
Yeah, sure, that wasn't going to happen anytime soon.
Right. The Massachusetts Government Act, which gave the British basically control over the Massachusetts government. Sure that went over like a lead balloon.
I'm sure they listened to him totally.
Administration of Justice Act, which allowed royal officials accused of crimes against colonials to be tried in other parts of the British Empire, so basically someplace where they wouldn't be judged so harshly. The Quartering Act, allowing governors to house British soldiers in other buildings if colonists basically didn't provide housing for the soldiers, because it was, for a long time, it was a requirement that you, if a British soldier needed a place to stay, you had to open your house to them. But they were clearly starting to refuse British soldiers that room and board.
This is mandating them to.
Or that and other buildings.
Oh,
like they
could, like they
open
could
up
take
like
the church or something and
public buildings. I just don't think those were included naturally. So 1774, from September to October, the First Continental Congress met and called for a boycott of all British goods, which would have been a lot of things at that point.
A lot of things. I mean,
I mean, there's a lot of resources in the new fledgling country, but
But Britain was, they had a stranglehold on the shipping and what was coming in and what was going out. So if all of a sudden they weren't buying any of the British goods, that would have been, that would have made things like sugar and molasses and the other stuff hard to come by.
By the end of 1775, leading into 1776, most of the colonists that were part of government and in the know about all these things believed war with Britain was just inevitable at that point. I mean, especially after the year before calling a boycott of British goods.
Yeah.
So there was a call for independence starting to form. And then in March and April of 1775, probably before that, the battles of Lexington and Concord sparked the beginning of the Revolutionary War.
Right.
So, all right. 1775, also, a lot of things happened in the same years here coming up because it was really starting to blow up.
Yeah, it moved fast war was inevitable and things moved fast from there.
Yeah. So in 1775, the Second Continental Congress was formed, and this focused on functioning as a national government in order to form armies and strategize. So the First Continental Congress was more to just get everybody together and say, hey, we need to govern ourselves. Let's get out from under the thumb of Britain. And then the second one was formed to essentially build on that and
create an actual government.
Yeah, create an actual government and pull people in, form armies, and get ready to fight a war.
Yep.
So early 1776, Thomas Paine published Common Sense, which was a pamphlet encouraging colonists to strive for independence from Great Britain. This paved the way for the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, so I've always heard of Common Sense, but I wasn't really sure what the overall role of it was, but it sounds like it reached a lot of people and helped to solidify the ideas that the Declaration of Independence ultimately put forward.
Right.
Yeah.
July 2nd, 1776, the Second Continental Congress basically put forth the Lee Resolution, which was a call to vote for independence from Britain. And then July 4th, 1776, Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence, drafted by Thomas Jefferson and edited by the Second Continental Congress. And then, so that's it, right? July 4th, so that's when it was...
1776.
Yeah, that's when it was adopted.
76.
Yeah.
We are independent. And Britain's still like, who's independent?
Yeah, right. Who are you guys?
Shut up. Shut up and go home.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, and I didn't know this part. I don't even remember hearing this in Philadelphia when we were there. It's entirely possible that we did. But it wasn't until September 3rd, 1783, a whole 7 years later, the end of the Revolutionary War. So it took that long with the Treaty of Paris, where Britain officially recognized the independence of the United States.
Ah, okay. Well, yeah. I knew the Revolutionary War lasted for a while, but gosh, 7 years. I don't think I realized it was that long.
I mean, I would imagine, I didn't know it was that long either, but it surprised me a little bit that it took them that long to recognize independence, but I guess they really couldn't do it until the war was over.
Yeah.
Because up until then, they could still win the war and then, squash the independence,
Well, they needed Britain to recognize their independence. So, because until they recognize it, as far as they were concerned, the United States was still a colony of Britain. So they needed that recognition. So it makes sense.
All right. So let's find out what's been happening in the rest of the world. And now we're going to move over to China. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, Timelines, episode 136. And of course, we just spent all of segment one talking about the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the future United States, 1776. And You know, when I was setting this episode up, I was just kind of looking around to see what happened else in the world in the late 1700s. And I found some interesting stuff about China.
Yeah.
It was an interesting time in China's history. And so that's what we're going to talk about. There's honestly nothing really specific that happened in 1776, but
like
it's really
the year
more
of.
Yeah, but it's really more like late 1700s China. What were they dealing with?
Yeah.
There were some things around that year that were actually happening, but it again, it really just kind of highlights the fact that they were dealing with their own stuff. So, but anyway, I'm going to get a lot of the pronunciation of this stuff wrong as well, so just prepare yourself for that.
Yes.
So, from 1711 to 1799, the Chinese people were under the rule of the Qinlong Emperor, and it might be Qinlong, but I'm not sure, but it's Q-I-A-N. I'm going to say Qinlong. Mm-hmm. That's probably wrong, but the Qinlong Emperor, 1711 to 1799. 1776 itself was a year of relative peace for the, I think it's Qing, but it's Q-U-I-N-G. Sorry, Q-I-N-G, the Qing Dynasty. I'm just going to say it that way.
Yep.
I'm wrong, but there it is. We spelled it. So, actually, a couple things. One thing that did happen was completed in 1776 was a lavish residence for the eventual retirement of the emperor in the Forbidden City. So the emperor right there in the Forbidden City, he actually wouldn't retire for a really long time after that. And he was, I think we get into this a little later, but he was one of the longest ruling monarchs in Chinese history.
Well, I imagine he went to 1799 if that's when the end of that dynasty happened, right?
Yeah.
So he must have gone another 25-ish years.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So China was under an absolute monarchy as opposed to the democracy that was forming in the future United States, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So the final imperial dynasty of China was 1644 to 1912. What that means was China was no longer under this sort of emperor type regime after 1912.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what they call the rulers of China after that, but it wasn't like emperor.
Right.
Yeah. So imperial dynasty implies there's an emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They just didn't call them the emperor after 1912.
Yeah. It's like dear leader now, right?
Yeah. No, so, that's North Korea.
That's North Korea.
They probably have their own words for that. But
right.
Yeah. So anyway, this whole time in China in particular was noted for its initial prosperity. There was a lot of good things going on, and then some tumultuous final years, which led to basically the end of the imperial dynasty.
Yeah, and it transformed into communism after that, basically, right?
So eventually,
like that, these imperial years at the end especially kind of are what helped communism take hold of the country. So
So what ended up starting the Qing dynasty, it's got to be Qing, I don't know, but the Qing dynasty, it was preceded by the Ming dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they were probably most well known for their vases.
Yeah.
Because anytime you see a freaking vase or something like that in a movie, it's always Ming dynasty.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Early 16th century. I'm actually quoting Indiana Jones.
Oh, Sean Connery?
Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, oh, thank God it's a fake. Anyway. But anyway, the Ming dynasty was defeated in 1616 by Manchurian forces from northeastern Asia, which paved the way for the Emperor Shunzi to establish the Qing dynasty. Qinlong ascended to the throne in 1735 and spent 60 years ruling. He was actually, this is really interesting, he was very disinterested in ruling at all. Like, he basically just like let his functionaries do it, and was preoccupied with all his artistic pursuits, including over 42,000 published poems.
So many poems.
Yeah.
Like that's like multiple poems a day.
Well, and here's the thing. I didn't actually write this in our notes, but I remember reading this. A lot of the poems he actually wrote on the artwork that was in the palace.
Oh, really?
Like hanging on the walls. Like he just went around and wrote it on the artwork, like this poetry that he did.
Well, you see a lot of those like rolls that are part of Chinese artistic works or whatever have a lot of writing in them. So I guess they were his poems.
Well,
I wonder
if
they're any good. I mean, was he a good writer? Was he a good poet?
Didn't really look up any examples of that. The society at this time was conservative and became even more so throughout time as they did this. And conservative from like a U.S. definition of conservative, I think.
Were they like historically conservative, like compared with the other places around the world, or
that I don't know, but it did say their conservatism like just progressed and got worse and worse and worse.
And
worse if you don't like conservatism, I guess.
Yeah.
But conservatism. But anyway, for example, they had worsening penalties for homosexuals. Purity in women was at an increased demand, which led an increase in men refusing to accept widows as brides. I didn't know. I guess they were doing that before, but now they're like, you kind of been married before, so you're impure now. I'm not going to marry you.
That is crazy. Yeah. That is so crazy, because that's kind of the opposite of how widows are viewed in European societies.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, and not surprisingly, this led to an increase in suicide in widows and the creation of homes for widows where interaction with men was limited.
Ooh, now, yeah. I could imagine living in one of those homes. That would be fun.
Maybe.
Well, for me anyway, it would just be like, I don't know, like just hanging with like your best gal pals all day long, all the time.
Right.
No men in there mucking things up.
I know, right? So one of the things this emperor was known for was leading. And when they say leading, he was disinterested in all of this stuff. So I'm wondering if he just was like, yeah, whatever. And his generals did it. You know what I mean? Which was like, what, Tom Cruise and...
oh, my God.
Yeah. Did you see that movie? Anyway.
It was a horrible movie, but... Last Samurai, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So anyway, Tom Cruise, Last Samurai. So
I think that was Japanese too, but go on.
Yeah, Samurai.
Yeah, you're getting all of your references
wrong. But he was
wrong.
On like the Great Wall.
Yeah,
it was
that's
all
right.
Wrong.
Yeah, everything is probably
it
all
was
wrong.
All bad. Were there aliens too?
I don't think in that movie.
Oh, okay.
But maybe. Who knows?
Anyway, so one of the things he was relatively well known for was leading what they call the 10 Great Campaigns, which is a series of military campaigns designed to enlarge the area of control over the basically the empire and various police actions to help bring people in line, essentially.
This is probably in line with their more conservative politics and ideals. They just needed to bring people under this same control, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, one reason why they probably weren't concerned with the fledgling United States and what was happening over there, and I'm sure they were aware of it. I mean, they're modern, for the time, they were a modern country, part of the world, and had explorers and people bringing them info. So,
yeah, there's a fair bit of interaction between the East and West at that point.
Yeah, I would say so. One of the 10 great campaigns was the suppression of the Jinshuan Hill peoples, which took place in two separate campaigns, 1747 to 1749, and then 1771 to 1776. Mm-hmm. So right during, you know, right as we're declaring independence, they're like nearing the end of a costly and difficult and destructive war, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was the most destructive of the 10 campaigns.
And it was putting down a rebellion of a group of people. And it sounds like in this case, the rebellion did not win. Unlike the Americans. So that would be one big difference between what was happening there and what was happening in the United States.
Yeah, one huge difference. The area that the Jinshuan area was located northwest of Chengdu in the western Sichuan province. So kind of far away from the capital. The first campaign that I mentioned, 1747 to 49, was essentially pretty simple for them to handle and induced the native chieftains there to basically to accept a peace plan. Basically, they bribed them.
Yep.
So they said, hey, do this and you'll have peace. But obviously that didn't work. And conflict brought the emperor back after 20 years and cost the imperial treasury several times the amounts expended during earlier conquests. Mm-hmm. So they really took a bath on that little conflict.
Yep.
The resisting tribes retreated to the stone towers, which I thought was really cool. Stone towers and forts in steep mountains and were only dislodged by repeated cannon fire.
Kind of like early guerrilla warfare. Sounds like they retreated to places where the imperial army wasn't necessarily comfortable going, but the imperial army had cannons. So, cannons. It's kind of hard to compete with that.
Yep. The imperial generals annihilated local Tibetans in the area and reorganized the region in what they call a military prefecture and repopulated it with more cooperative inhabitants. I don't know what that means. Like they kill everybody and brought in their own people to live there?
That's
kind of what it sounds like.
Question. Well, I mean, if there's a big long, well, not super long, but definitely a few years long war to put down this rebellion, then I mean, there probably weren't a lot of men left in the region, right? Because they probably did mostly die in the conflicts.
Right.
And if you bring in men that are more cooperative and marry them into the remaining women and families that are left, then I guess it would turn it into a more cooperative area. I could see that tactic working. I wonder if that is what they mean by that.
I don't know. Either way, the point is they were dealing with a lot of conflict internally as a country. They were already a country dealing with the outlying, you know, provinces.
Very similar to what the British were going through with their outlying provinces, outlying areas, except that theirs was, you know, colonialization and taking control of areas. And then,
I have a feeling if the British Empire had established more of a foothold in North America, what became North America, and really ruled from there rather than trying to rule from England, this would have turned out very differently because the Chinese were able to, you know, this is on their own soil, essentially, or soil they were trying to make their own, but at least adjacent, not, not an entire ocean away. Yep. And that's really hard, you know, because it takes a long time for even just messages to get back and forth, months probably.
Yeah, they're dealing with those same restrictions in China, but not having an ocean in between, of course, helped. And it sounds like they established an area of power in the areas that were rebelling to control them and squash the rebellion eventually. So
I feel like the Chinese could have done a real Lord of the Rings thing and just lit fires on the mountaintops to communicate.
My favorite scene in the Lord of the Rings
it's
movies.
So good.
I love it.
It's really almost like light speed communication. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's super fast.
Yeah,
it really
totally.
Is at the speed of light. As long as the thing I always had a problem with that though was, and that's historically accurate. Like that's happened before, right? I don't know when or who, but I know that that's been done before. The problem is, even though it's manned like 24 hours a day, I mean, come on. Are they really just watching the other one? Can they really see it that well?
Yeah.
They were a long ways away.
Yeah.
I don't know how the movie
would it happen
it
immediately like it did in the movie. I don't know. But
like, oh my God, a fire, you know? So anyway, so point is they had enough problems of their own and they probably weren't paying attention a whole lot to the U.S. And we were, you know, China is not only an entire ocean, but also pretty much at that time, most of North America away. So it was a long ways away. You know, even though Chinese were already in North America, there were already Chinese people there. And there were already Chinese people starting to really come over to the Pacific coast. And it's just still, it was a completely just foreign thing that they just weren't concerned with it. It was a whole entire world away. So
one other thing that is kind of a, I don't know how big it is, but a difference definitely between what was happening in China and what was happening in the United States is that the British were basically fighting other Europeans who were either former British citizens or other citizens of Europe, but people that were originally culturally very similar to them, right? The Native Americans weren't really much of a factor at all in these wars. They were doing their own thing still at that point, right? Whereas in China, they're actually fighting the native populations of whatever area, the tribal groups of the area. So I think that made for a different kind of conflict completely when they were fighting. It was two different cultural groups that were fighting. So kind of interesting to think of it that way. And maybe that's why the Americans were able to be successful against the British, is because their roots were the same. So they were coming from the same place.
All right. Well, we are going to cover three continents in this episode and go over to Africa. And we're going to spend the next segment listening to Rachel pronounce these words.
My turn.
Yeah. So I first read this as the inmates of Futatoro, but it's the Imamate, probably.
Imamate.
So we're going to talk about them on the other side of the break. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to episode 136 of the Archaeology Show. And in this third and final segment of our timelines episode, we are going to move sort of halfway in between the first two, kind of. I don't know if you're like looking at a spread out globe.
It's more down and to the
like
left.
Down and over and in between.
Yeah, we're going to move kitty corner.
we're moving away from both of them to Africa. So I was looking for more information about what was going on in the rest of the world during 1776. And it's honestly kind of hard to find information about a specific year, even a year where we have a lot of historical information. But this popped up, and the Imamate of Futatoro, And this is a group that basically took hold in West Africa along the Senegal River right around 1776. I think in the year of 1776 is when they like finally like solidified their power.
So this was before the iron ship from the Civil War made its way up that river and then beached itself there for Matthew McConaughey to find much later in the movie Sahara.
Oh man, so many bad movie references in this episode.
I love that movie. It's so bad.
I didn't even know what you're talking about. Like, I was giving you the eyes of, like, where are you going with this the whole time you were talking?
We will link to Sahara in the show notes.
I'm not in linking fact, to that movie. Not. I'm not doing that. Not happening.
Actually, a great movie. All right.
Oh, is it? Anyway. So, in this area, pre-1776, the area was under the control of a kingdom called the Dinanke Kingdom. And these are it's a pre-Muslim kingdom. And honestly, I looked around and the religion is kind of unclear. I think that they were technically Muslim, but they were more like Muslim in name, but not really practicing super strictly the way that Muslims today do. It was just a time period where religion wasn't taking a center stage role in the group, right?
Probably a lot of tribal religious influence still taking
probably
hold.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that the Dinanke, they ruled this area. It was all along the Senegal River, and the Senegal River is pretty, it runs like east-west-ish, like straight through Western Africa, right? And they had this like long skinny section all along the river. So it's a really fertile, really desired area to be in, right? And there's a lot of lower class Muslim people in this area. And that class was growing and growing and growing over time. And because of the lack of religiosity of the Dinanke rulers, if that word is correct. They were just becoming discontent with this leadership and they wanted to see a more strict religious following. So this is very much religious based. Now, leading up to 1776, several jihads were launched that helped fracture the Dinanke kingdom's power. And what that did was lead to a scattering of these theocratic jihad states. And if you're not familiar with what a jihad is, it's an Arabic word that literally means striving or struggling. And it especially has a praiseworthy aim, like praiseworthy being by Allah or God or whatever. So it's like a struggle in the name of God, I guess, is kind of what that means. So these jihads are happening. It's fracturing power. The Dinanke are losing power. They're losing their foothold. And there's a bunch of them. And then finally, in 1769, the jihad in Fouta Toro, which is one of the sections along the Senegal River. So a jihad started in that area. It ended in 1776. And that was what finally ousted the Dinanke rulers in this region.
Okay.
So you're probably wondering who won this jihad, who started the jihad and who finally won it and what they did with the region once they took control. So the jihad was started by a class of Muslim clerics and scholars known as the Toradobi. And they were led by a bunch of different people. And the one who finally like won the battles, who finally like ousted the Dinanke was Suleiman Baal. Yeah, Suleiman Baal. He died in 1776, though. So he like gets through this whole like conflict.
Yeah.
And then he literally dies like the same year that they finally win. So unfortunately for him, he didn't get to, you know, reap the benefits of the struggle for very long.
Mm-hmm.
But the Toradobi were a group of people that they developed originally out of this like diverse group of West African farmers. They were all united by a common language called Pular. And of course they were Islamic. So, and those, the overall group of all of them was the Tokelar. So you've got the Tokelar at the top here and then the Toradobi developed from this group. And, and they were mostly clerics and scholars and things. After Suleiman died, Abdul Qadir became the first al-Mami of the theocratic Emma Mate Afutatoro. I did not think I was going to struggle with these words as much as I am. Like, I said them over and over in my head, but saying them out loud is a totally different thing.
Yeah.
Al-Mami is a title of West African Muslim rulers. It was used especially in the conquest of states in the 19th century. So this is a little bit before that, but they were using this title at that point. Mm-hmm. And the power that these people had, it comes from a community of Muslim people who are giving them their power and saying, yes, please, you know, take control of this area. So Abdul Qader was the first Al-Mami of the Imamate Afutatoro. And they were really prosperous for a long time. They were very Muslim, very religious. They focused a lot on creating this strict, these strict Muslim protocols in the city. A lot of what is still in place today in a lot of these African countries that are primarily Muslim, a lot of what is followed today was developed in this time period mm-hmm. when the strict Muslim people had gained control of the country. And they showed this by, they spent a lot of the 1700s building mosques and also aggressively warring with their non-Muslim neighbors and adding more people and more land to their Muslim community and basically spreading out from there and taking over a large portion of this area. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing, too, is they negotiated a treaty with France to stop France from taking Muslim slaves. Because what French ships would do is sail up this river, the Senegal River, and basically just kidnap native people, Muslim people, and turn them into slaves, right?
Yeah.
So they negotiated this treaty to stop the French from doing that. However, they actively participated in slavery in their own state. They never ended it, even though there were several promises over the years to end it. And by the early 1800s, the ruler, Abdul Qader, who had promised to end slavery, he had died at this point. And no single person ever took full control of the Imamate after that. Control was sort of passed to a group of high-class families, high-class Toradobe families mm-hmm. who continued with the Muslim practices and just really emphasizing the religious part of the community and the warring, the taking over the non-Muslim states and the ending slavery and some of the other stuff that they were planning on doing just sort of never happened. And I think it just, When the area became so completely controlled by a group of families who had all the power, it was a very Game of Thrones-ish, you know, where like the lower classes and the poor people just had no power. They just had no power again, and they couldn't do anything. So,
yeah. So let me clarify on the slave issue there. So they weren't necessarily upset that France was making slaves out of Muslims, but that France was taking their slaves.
Like from what I was reading, like they were completely okay with slavery. They just didn't want,
like, hey, French, we need those slaves.
Yeah, those are our people to enslave.
Yeah. Wow. So I wonder who they were. Well, I wonder, A, who the French were basically taking as slaves, if they just didn't care as long as they were not white, essentially. And who these guys were taking as slaves, because were the French basically just taking anybody, or were they all pulling from the same pool?
Yeah, I didn't follow the slavery thread too deeply, so I'm not really sure exactly who was being taken from where and how or anything like that. But I do know that they definitely had slavery of their own people in their state. So and France was sort of the strongest European power in this part of Africa. And actually, they are the ones who ended up causing the Imamate of Afutatoro to basically not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 1800s, they had the power had fractured and it was controlled by these couple families. And it was just, they just didn't have the same control that they had earlier when it was a single ruler of a theocratic state. It just became fractured under these families, and it just made it easy for the French to group all of them under the French flag at this point. So that was how that ended. Just became French territory, essentially.
I think the French originally went there because they had heard that there was a Nigerian prince who was trying to get a lot of money out of the country, and he just needed help.
Yeah, he just needed your bank account information. Just that's all.
The French banking information.
If you could just send that over, he would send you all kinds of euros.
Yeah, he was like, listen, I'll share this with you.
All the francs.
We just need to get this out of here. So if you could come down here, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And the French came down there. We're like, yeah, we'll also take your slaves.
So it was just an interesting time period in Africa where you can see the development of these really strict Muslim cultures and these Muslim theocratic states that would take control. And people were super happy and excited about it because they wanted a stricter Muslim. They wanted to live under a stricter Muslim society. It just felt truer, I think, to them than the extravagances of the previous rulers who were not necessarily, who were Muslim in name only. Yeah. So they liked it. And then, you know, it just, all good things must come to an end, I guess. Yeah. And the power just started fracturing, and then it made it so that France could come in and take it over.
Right.
Yep.
Well, that pretty much ends our second Timelines episode. I would say if you can think of if you got a favorite anchor event as defined in segment one, send it over to us, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, or just wherever you find the podcast. You can comment there too, I'm sure. Facebook, Twitter, or on the page. Don't leave like a review on iTunes. I'll honestly never see that. I mean, please leave a review on iTunes, but don't ask me
a question. Please leave 5-star reviews on iTunes, please. Please leave 5-star reviews.
If you're going to leave 1-star reviews, go do it on the Life in Ruins podcast. No, I'm kidding. Don't do that.
Don't do that. Oh, my God.
That. Yeah.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, please give us suggestions. We're going to start coming up with a lot more of these. We've got a couple producers on the show now, some volunteer producers. So I think we'll be able to do a lot more of that. Just as kind of a side note, I researched Australia for this. And because I'm working with a lot of Australian people right now. And I was really interested in like what was going on in Australia in the late 1700s. All the timelines I could see on like a kind of a cursory research were like, Australia was prehistoric from 60,000 years ago until Europeans, and then the timeline started.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell? How about a little more, like, what was going on?
I know. I noticed the same thing, and I wonder if it's just you have to dig deeper to find the specific sources for the different regions.
It was just disappointing that all the timelines started with basically, here's this huge chunk of 50,000 years, then white people.
Yeah, like, sometime in the 1780s is when like Botany Bay started becoming the place that convicts were sent to, and Britain took a foothold in Australia really at that point. So there was nothing in 1776 that I could find, but you know, people were there. So the fact that I couldn't find it just means that there's not a whole lot published about the native populations of Australia, which was unfortunate.
Interestingly, from a future historical standpoint, the Botany Bay was the name of the ship that Khan in Star Trek 3 or 2 3 3 was also on, and it was basically a ship full of convicts, and it was called the Botany Bay.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, obviously.
let's just count here. We've talked about Harry Potter. We've talked about Lord of the Rings. I think Sahara.
Don't forget Sahara.
Star Trek.
And of course, segment one, I didn't tell you our complete source for that. It's of course National Treasure by the Nick Cage. We stood in a long line at Independence Hall. I didn't mention this, but we stood in a long line just to get in there. And it was really just kind of long because they were really practicing social distancing and making sure they had small groups going in.
It took like 2 hours to get in.
It was a while. Yeah. But I was like watching National Treasure on my iPhone and seeing the places where they went in Independence, where he's like running across the top of the building.
Finding Ben Franklin's glasses in the brick or whatever. Yeah.
And turns out the model of Independence Hall that they used is at Knott's Berry Farm in Southern California. Which is real disappointing.
Yep. Yeah. So good. You've gotten your National Treasure reference in. I'm pretty sure you talked about Indiana Jones at some point. So yeah, good job. You've gotten references to all your favorite archaeology nerd movies into this episode.
That's right. So all the IMDb links will be in the show notes.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. All right. Well, thanks a lot. And again, if you have any suggestions for these Timelines anchor episodes, or maybe even something that's more obscure that you know of, and we'll try to find something around that time and then just include it in the episode. So that would be pretty cool. But otherwise, we're just going to find stuff on our own. You're going to have to listen to us talk about it.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and we will see you next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.